Everybody, welcome to Here I Am Orphan Ministries brand new podcast. This is our second episode, and we are so excited to welcome back Sue today. She presented with us last fall during the Building Stronger Families webinar, if you ever joined us for that. And we're so excited to welcome her back to speak on the adolescent brain. So I'm going to turn it over to her so that we can get started.
All right. Thank you so much, Brittany. And I'm so happy to be here with you and the families who are joining by listening in. There's been a tremendous explosion of research and knowledge about adolescent development and adolescent brain development in particular in the last 7 to 10 years in particular. And having that information, some of that information, and just understanding sort of what's going on inside that head of that teen that you may be caring for, whether as a, you know, biological parent, as a foster parent, a kinship caregiver, or an adoptive parent, just having a little more of this sort of science base of what's going on and how that actually applies to what you see outwardly in the mannerism and the behavior and the just affect and everything of your teen, and then what kinds of things you can do to best sort of help with that brain development is so important. And in the past, before we knew, you know, decades ago, before we knew much about child development at all, there was kind of a thinking that infants were blank slates and that everything sort of got written on those slates as they developed over time. That definitely became debunked as people studied human and particularly child development. And what came next was a really just big body of knowledge about the importance of early childhood and that those babies and those toddlers and what goes on developmentally there in those first 1, 2, 3 years, in those first 5 years, even 7 years. And that is all true, and there's been additional knowledge added to that in recent years as well. But what it did often lead to was this idea that it was kind of a window of opportunity that kids either got what they needed or it was kind of too late after that, and that everything was pretty well formed and good luck. It did hinder good parenting. It did hinder good educational strategies and other ways of thinking about how to best interact and engage with older children and teens. This idea that sort of they were fully, their brains and their capacity was kind of fully formed in those early years. It especially hindered the ability of older youth, 10 and up especially, to get good opportunities to have successful placements in the foster care system and in permanency in terms of adoption or kinship care. Definitely that way of thinking definitely hindered that, as people would sort of think, well, I don't know what I'm getting and I'm not really going to have much chance for influence. And if this child has had bad experiences, they've kind of been damaged and it's too late. So what's really exciting about the new body of knowledge that's emerging is that none of that is true anymore. The adolescent brain, the period of adolescence, is just a tremendous growth period and window of new opportunity for that emerging young person to really develop and grow and be influenced by people and relationships around them. So I am always particularly excited to have the opportunity to share this information with people who do become foster parents or kinship caregivers or adoptive parents to older children and teens, that just to recognize what a great opportunity you have. So that's what we're going to spend the next 50, 55 more minutes talking about. I have two videos during the course of this presentation that I'll share, and the first one is coming right up in a moment, that will also help add to this this knowledge that I will be sharing with you. And just for those of you who don't know me or who I am, I live in Philadelphia, but 40 plus years ago, I lived in New England where I grew up, and my husband and I became foster parents for the first time. Just out of our college years ourselves, just 21, just barely out of college, and we became foster parents for teenagers. And in the years, in the 40 plus years since then, we have fostered over 75 young people, mostly teens. We've adopted 20 children in addition to our two birth children that we've raised permanently. And a large number of those that we adopted into our permanent family also were teens. So this is something I've lived, walked the walk, lived in the trenches, and I'm so passionate about ensuring that every teen has the opportunity to be really welcomed and belong in a family that truly is committed to them and loves them and cares about them. So that's why I bring such a passion to this topic that we'll be discussing today. So before I go further with my remarks, I really wanted to just share with you this one little video. It's a young girl who made her own life story video and just talking about some of the experiences she went through while in foster care. And I want you to just listen to it for some of those teen behaviors and how she describes what was going on underneath them as she was having them. And then also kind of listen with your other ear for what it must have been like to be her parent. She talks about her foster parents, especially her foster mom, what it must have been like to be that foster mom experiencing these behaviors of this teen and how that foster mom really hung in there and what a difference that made. So I'd like you to listen to that for the next couple of minutes and then I'll come back online with you.
In 2000, I was a scared little freshman meeting the two people who had changed my life forever. My new foster parents, Bob and Debbie Boyles. Bob and I instantly became the best of friends, but with Debbie, it was a lot harder. It has always been hard for Debbie and I to see eye to eye because we are such different people. Now I love Debbie so much for everything she has ever done for me. But for some reason, I always used to find a way to make her cry. By telling her I don't love her, yelling, I hate you, not receiving her gifts, and shutting her out of my life. The first year, things were always up and down between us. It was so hard for me to realize that Debbie was just trying to help me and not be like my mom. Hateful words would always come out of my mouth when I spoke to or about Debbie. I was so blinded by the lie that all women are just like my mother, never there for me, especially when I needed the most help. I wish I could take back all the hateful things I have ever said to Debbie, but you can't erase the past, you just have to make up for it. It took a lot of things that Debbie did for me to open my eyes. She would treat me like the world, and all I could say was, oh, thanks. What I really should have said was, I love you, you're the best. Why was it so hard for me to tell Debbie how I really feel about her? Was it because I was hurt so much as a child, or was it because I had a heart made of ice? I think it was both, because not having love as a child made me hate the world. I wish there were a lot more parents out there like Bob and Debbie. From the start, they believed in me, but it took so long for me to see that. I look back now, and I wish I would have said, I love yous, in the place of all thy hate yous. Well, guess what? I've changed so much, and now I don't think I could ever repay Bob and Debbie with all the joy they have brought to my life. Now I believe you when you say you love me. I believe you when you say you'll always be there for me, and now I truly believe I deserve to have parents forever. Bob, Debbie, I love you guys so much, and I thank you for everything. You guys are truly heaven sent.
I hope you'll agree with me that that's a powerful and touching video of a young person sort of sharing her journey. And we can watch it in something like 3 minutes and take that whole journey. And so we get to that ending point in 3 minutes when she says, oh, Bob and Debbie, I love you so much and thank you for all you've done for me. Now, first of all, that's a little extreme because it's not often, even with the best circumstances that are teens really reach that point where they verbalize and say, oh, thank you. Or often that comes much later in life, sometimes at the time when they, have their own child or some other life event sort of makes them reflect on their time with you as their parent and them. But nevertheless, as we watch that video in, like I said, just a couple of minutes and see that whole journey, it doesn't feel terribly excruciating. But if you think about some of the things that she said in there, she said the first year was hard and then the next year. I mean, these parents that she is now expressing love and gratitude to only were able to get there with her and only were able to eventually get that reciprocal relationship with her after going through the trenches of several years of her saying, I hate you, and her rejecting them, and her not being able to get close, and all the other kinds of things that she said she was doing. So I like to use her story, and I appreciate it and thank her for it, to kick us off on this topic to realize, you know, adolescent development, all of human development, is a journey, and to get where we hope we will want to go for ourselves and for those that we care about and parent, we have to have tremendous patience and perseverance and commitment and dedication to get through the rough spots. As the illustration in this next slide that I'm showing you demonstrates, which was done by a teen in foster care, you know, there's a tremendous amount of hope, and youth are envisioning themselves flying towards their future. And as you picture just any room full of adolescents and think about what you're seeing and hearing and what they might be doing, a lot of young people are really soaring. They're volunteering, they're starting, they're taking on roles in leadership and student government, they're emerging athletes or artists or musicians, they're mentoring or tutoring or supporting their younger siblings or other younger children in the community. There's so much of a wealth of good, positive things that happen with our adolescents in our world. But we also know, particularly for youth who have had a history of being in care or traumatized in any way, and really the trauma information we know is that this begins very, very early. So even if you brought a child into your home moments after they were born, there can still be trauma that's transmitted because of what happened during pregnancy and because of what happened during those birth moments and because of what happened in terms of separating that child from their whole biological family. So whether the adolescent that's in your home got to you as an older child that you took in by fostering or adopting, or whether that child came to you as a newborn, there is still this high likelihood that there's this imprint of trauma there that is another layer of what's happening when we see and hear and experience what they're doing. So for all of our teens, adolescence is a time when it's really risky to be a teen. There's a lot of risk-taking that they have to do just to reach out and make friends, to look at big life questions like, who am I and where do I belong? Where's my place in this world? You know, what's my role with my peers? All of these are pretty normal processes of feelings and thoughts and developmental tasks that adolescents are going through that are only sort of made more complex by any experiences of separation and loss from their original family, again, whether that happened at infancy or later. And just to help you think about that a little on a personal level, imagine yourself back being a young teen yourself, and imagine you woke up one day with one pimple on your face, pimple, zit, whatever your preferred term was at the time of your own adolescence. Imagine that horror. Imagine what you thought about if you even wanted to go to school that day. And when I do this exercise or this thought process in a live class with people in front of me, they often say things like, I didn't want to go to school. I wanted to hide under the covers. And when I ask why, people say, well, everyone was going to notice. It was going to make me different. It's going to make me stand out and not in a good way. And you see, most people wouldn't have noticed that one pimple or that one zit because they're all dealing with their own. But the power of that moment of feeling that I'm going to stand out not in a good way is even present for all of us who have, any of us who have had a very stable, healthy, happy childhood and upbringing and are in a good, solid situation in our teen years. How much more so is that true for our young people who've had any history in foster care or coming into the adoption system through whatever door that they came through? So we have to keep that in mind and recognize that what our teens who are in foster care or who came to us for adoption or kinship care, they need a variety of things. And so this is kind of the big framing piece that I'll put forward here that will then be broken down further in the remainder of our time together this morning. So teens in care, like all teens, need these, especially these five things that I've highlighted here. But again, there's the added complexity that comes when they've had a history of loss or trauma of any kind. I want to point out the artwork here, and you've seen a couple other pieces of artwork on slides I've already shown and others that will come. When you see artwork, not clip art, you know the difference, but when you see actual artwork like this, it comes from the work of youth themselves who were in foster care or adoptive homes, when you see the colorful artwork. And so this is how one young person just kind of pictured their life. The theme of the artwork was my life, my voice, my future. When you see artwork that looks like a coloring page, and there'll be a few of those ahead, that comes from a book that I wrote, and the artist is my daughter, and it's called Building Bridges of Hope, Caring for Children Who've Experienced Trauma. So just wanted to let you know where the different artwork comes from that you'll be seeing. But children need these five things, so let's just unpack them for a moment, and then, like I said, the rest of our time together will take that even further. Every teen needs to know that they're safe. Now, this goes beyond just being physically safe and us as an adult being able to confirm, yep, I think they're safe, to that real sense of psychological safety. I feel comfortable. I feel accepted. I feel welcome. I feel like I belong. And that sense of belonging then goes into the second important need, which is the need for lasting relationships. This is one of the big things the new research has really heavily underscored is it's not enough to have a bunch of serial relationships, people that kind of come and go in your life. They can have positive effects, whether it's a teacher that you have for only one grade or only one subject, whether it's a coach, whether it's a foster parent that you had for only a week. People that come and go in your life like that can definitely have a positive influence. You probably all can look back on your own opportunities where you had mentors and caregivers and loved ones that weren't there for your whole life, but for whatever season they were there, really made a lasting impact. So that is valuable, but it's not enough. Young people also need what we call lasting relationships. So that's that permanent family, that adoptive family, or back with their birth family that really sticks with them and sticks with them forever. It includes sibling relationships. It includes other extended family or caring adults that really are there for the long haul. They need skills for life, and this is very important. I'll come back to it later as well. Sometimes, though, we get bogged down in the idea of adolescents needing skills, and we put them in a lot of classes for life skills or independent living, and forget that skills, as important as it is only one piece of this much broader picture of what they need. They need resources. They need the kinds of services and community supports and access to opportunities for all their various life domains, whether that's medical, mental health, social, recreational, academic, all these different kinds of resources. And then when you put all those first four together, they contribute towards this final need, which is being called here self-efficacy, that idea that I have a voice and my voice matters. I don't control the universe. I don't control everything about my own life, but my life is not chaotic and out of control. That if I speak up, if I make a decision, if I do some problem solving, it's going to have some impact, that I do have a voice and it does matter. And that, again, is often something that children who've experienced trauma or multiple moves or any of the other or some other kinds of special needs often has been left out or repressed in their developmental trajectory. And so something we really need to nurture in them as they move into adolescence. So a lot of the newer, like I said, in the last decade or so, research that has emerged about adolescence helps us understand that becoming an adult is an emerging journey. If you look at this chart, which was developed by down in the corner, you'll see it says JCYOI. That was the Jim Casey Youth Opportunities Initiative. And they have a publication called The Adolescent Brain that is available and free to download online. You can look it up. Excellent resource. And one of the gifts from that resource is this beautifully laid out and easy to understand picture that whereas we sort of used to think you went through childhood and then you hit some age, somewhere around there, 18, that 18 mark, you know, maybe 20, 21, somewhere around there, you sort of became an adult. But what we're learning more and more about is that this whole process of becoming an adult and kind of growing into your adulthood is very much an emerging process. It continues. The developmental movement continues all through the entire remaining years of our life. We don't just sort of develop through childhood and then hit a line that we can cross and become an adult. And then from that point, we don't develop, we just age. The development continues. So that's a very fortunate thing to have this idea and this picture that the teen brain itself is still under construction. And so there's still so many windows of opportunity, as I said at the beginning of my time with you. Now I'm gonna show the second video, and this one's a little bit longer. It's about 8 or 9 minutes. It's the last video I'm gonna show. The rest of the time it'll be my sharing with you and the information on the slides. But I did want you to see this as kind of like a really fast talking guy. Just a quick overview of what would be more like a whole course on adolescent brain development. So I wanted you to see the science piece for these 8 or 9 minutes. And then I'm gonna move us quickly into, okay, well then what does that look like in terms of my actual teenager's behavior and what can I do as an adult to help them through this period and still survive it so I can get to that other side like Cassie in the opening video. So as I said, this is a little bit longer video, but I think you'll find it's worth it. You do have to really kind of pay attention because the narrator talks quite quickly. And you'll see here on the slide is the link for it if you want to later look it up yourself again.
Being a teenager is hard, and so is living with one, I'm told. No human gets to escape this moody, angsty, confusing phase. And interestingly, such an extended adolescence is unique to humans. Other animals grow up a lot faster than we do. And you may think our teen years are just about streamlining bodies for baby making, but as it turns out, the storms of sex hormones that we associate with the teenage years are only a small part of what's really going on in the teenage body. Most of the action, it turns out, is happening in the brain. Until fairly recently, we thought that the brain finished the nuts and bolts of its development by the time we started kindergarten. But really, right as puberty rolls in, it undergoes massive remodeling. This amounts to several years of neural growing pains, as well as the other more visible growth that's going on all over your body. So take heart! Whether you're going through it now, or about to go through it, or count yourself among the veterans of that turbulent decade, know that the result of the teen years is a stronger, faster, more sophisticated brain.
Someone had told me that 20 years ago.
Let's start with that obvious scapegoat of adolescent anguish, hormones. That word itself is kind of a lazy shorthand that people use to describe the chemicals that some of our glands excrete that can affect our behavior. But the fact is, hormones have all kinds of jobs that have nothing to do with where you grow hair, or what turns you on, or whether you feel glum for no apparent reason. Hormones keep your heart beating and your body hydrated, and they make your organs grow, and make you grow bone and muscle and skin. What people actually mean when they talk about teenage hormones are sex hormones. And yes, puberty involves a whole series of sex hormone storms, the first of switch actually kicks in before you're out of primary school. That's when the adrenal gland starts secreting androgens, which trigger the growth and activity of the skin's sebaceous glands, making skin more oily. Soon enough, more apocrine or sweat glands get activated, increasing body odor. Then comes the wave of hormonal agents that start activating the gonads. For boys, this influx of luteinizing hormones from the pituitary gland get testosterone brewing in the testes, and suddenly, that guy has up to 50 times more testosterone than he did before puberty. This also changes the shape of the male body, promoting hair growth and building up lean muscle mass, just as the increased presence of estrogen in girls rearranges the deposition of their fat, stimulating the growth of breasts. Humans are actually lucky to experience the craziness of puberty only once. Many other animals undergo multiple similarly intense hormonal rodeos as they enter sexually active periods, sometimes called the rut or heat, every new breeding season. Some male species completely stop eating during their breeding period because they're just that sex-crazed. And yet, all that said, teens are far less ruled than their hormones than you might think. There are other factors at play here. For example, your favorite moody teen may be by turns punchy, angry, depressed, or in a zombie-like fog because of their chronic lack of sleep. Sleep is vital to everyone, but it's especially important for kids and teens because it's during sleep that your pituitary gland releases an essential growth hormone necessary for development. A normal sleep cycle driven by circadian rhythm is regulated by the daytime release of cortisol, which helps you wake up, and melatonin, which helps you wind down when it gets dark. But this biology of sleep timing changes as we age, and as puberty begins, teens' sleep clocks get pushed back. Most adults start oozing melatonin around 10 p.m.-ish, but one study showed that teenagers don't start producing melatonin until closer to 1 a.m. This may be because puberty's hormonal frenzy is stalling the release of melatonin, and could partly explain why so many teens stay up late energized by the night, but have a really hard time rolling out of bed with the alarm. Of course, it's a bit of a chicken and egg deal, since watching reruns of The Simpsons and playing Call of Duty late at night continues to stimulate the brain, which may further delay the release of melatonin. Still, some researchers are starting to advocate for pushing back high school start times in the morning in the hopes of having more focused students. So we got sex hormones changing the bodies and a lack of sleep to contend with, but increasing evidence suggests that there is something much bigger at work that's making teenagers so teenagery. Their brains. It turns out that brains actually take longer than we thought to fully mature. I don't mean physical size. Our brains are already about 95% full size by the time we're just 6, but more in the sense of the connections inside the brain. Adults, for the most part, know how to make decisions by evaluating choices and weighing consequences. They do this with their prefrontal cortex, which is responsible for controlling impulses and emotions and forming judgments. Its neurons chat with the neurons in other regions of the brain responsible for, say, memory or movement through synapses. Thing is, teenage brains don't quite work like this yet. The prefrontal cortex may not be fully developed until your mid-20s, and teen synapses, those lines of communication, are still growing and specializing. They're also slow. As an adolescent brain keeps developing, its axons, the long tail-like parts of the neurons that transmit signals to other neurons, become more and more insulated by a fatty layer called the myelin sheath. This padding greatly increases the cell's transmission speed, and while it helps adults make faster decisions, it isn't fully formed in teens. These changes occur slowly, beginning at the back of the brain, where the oldest and most fundamental brain parts reside, and slowly working its way forward to the more advanced and complicated brain bits. The prefrontal cortex is the last to be hooked up and shaped. So it's important to keep in mind that just because your favorite teenager stayed up until sunrise binge-watching The Walking Dead the night before an exam, it doesn't mean they're dumb or lazy. Their brains are just literally finishing being built. But at the same time, because all this brain building is just starting to peak, this is also when the brain starts getting thinned out. You actually start losing connections that you don't use enough in a process called synaptic pruning, which has led to a theory that this is kind of a use-it-or-lose-it phase. Meaning, adolescence could be an especially important time to use your brain. Play an instrument, engage in sports, write poetry, learn a language. Because by doing these things, you're helping hardwire those synapses and giving your brain topiary a lovely, lasting shape. Whereas, if you're sitting around all day playing Candy Crush, those will be the connections that survive, which you don't need. This shaping of the teen brain manifests itself in other ways too, like in teenage attitudes. A group of scientists at the McLean Hospital in Massachusetts once hooked up a group of adults and a group of teens to MRI devices and then asked them to identify a series of expressions on photographs of adult faces. Interestingly, while adults correctly identified one expression as fear, the teenagers thought the faces showed anger, surprise, or shock. They weren't registering subtlety as well. Not only that, but the MRI images showed that adults and teens responded with different parts of their brains. Adults used the reasonable prefrontal cortex, while the teens mostly used the gut reaction emotional amygdala located farther back in the brain. Results like these might help explain why teenagers seem to experience frequent mood swings. For one, they tend to react quickly from the emotional part of their brain without running those reactions by the more rational frontal cortex. And two, it could be that they're just misreading expressions and therefore the intentions behind them. The frontal cortex also helps people relate to and understand each other, and you can imagine what happens when concern is misjudged as anger or worry as disappointment. The Fresh Prince has an entire song about it. But the truth is, as much as parents just don't understand, teens don't always understand either. When the emotional amygdala and the more rational cortex aren't fully hooked up yet, that can make it hard for teenagers to productively work through emotions. This kind of reactionary, impulsive behavior may also lead to more risk-taking. Adolescence is the time when we're most likely to experiment with whatever booze, drugs, or toad licking is available, and unfortunately, it's also the time our developing brains are most vulnerable to lasting effects. Studies have shown that teens are more likely to become addicted to drugs and alcohol than adults, partly because their brains are more attuned to their reward centers. While the teenage prefrontal cortex is still developing, their nucleus accumbens, or pleasure and reward zone, forms early on. Neuroimaging studies have shown that when presented with a big potential reward, teen brains light up way more than kids or adults' brains, but if the reward was small, teen brains hardly fired at all. So basically, give an adolescent a pat on the back, and you'll get a shrug. Give them a hot date or a winning goal, and their brains light up like Vegas. This, of course, does not always result in great judgment. A jacked-up, thrill-seeking impulse combined with an exquisite pang of peer pressure, plus a new driver's license, new sex parts, and access to substances can lead to some not good results. But still, this long and sometimes tedious remodeling process that our bodies go through in the teenage years isn't all bad. Many scientists have pointed out that our delayed adolescence lets our brains keep their flexibility longer, which, yeah, may make teens a little slow, but also more adaptable as they prepare for the adult world. In this way, you can see teen impulsiveness as boldness or independent thinking, and moodiness as a source of newfound empathy, and excitability as passion. Which means there's a lot of awesome energy floating around out there ready to decrease all kinds of world suck. Thanks for watching the SciShow.
But I hope that's the best quick way to sort of give you the science, the picture from the science of the adolescent brain. And this slide just recaps some of the key points as described in that booklet, The Adolescent Brain from JCYOI, that I mentioned to you earlier. There's a lot of dramatic changes happening in adolescence, as much change as what does happen in those early first couple of years of life. The term you might hear a lot is that there's a lot of neuroplasticity. That means the brain is flexible. And so what happens in those teen years is really critical. And it does mean that rewiring can happen, adverse effects of trauma can be healed, but that there's also sort of this use it or lose it window of opportunity here as we live with, love, and work with adolescents to really ensure that we do some of that healing and rewiring. So the next couple of slides we're going to look at really layer on, okay, that what we just saw, that video, didn't have anything to do with foster care or adoption. It was just generically the adolescent brain science, like what happens to the adolescent brain, what's going on inside there scientifically. But now we are going to look at the layering on of, well, what happens when there's loss, a history of some loss or some trauma. And so one thing we know is that just, again, forget, set aside any foster care or adoption type of experience. Adolescence itself is a period when there's a lot of losses going on for the young person. We don't always think about it that way, but when you're living in that skin and experiencing it, the young person is kind of losing their childhood. They're losing being a child. Now, most of them seem like they're really ready for that, and they're quickly wanting to say, I'm not a kid anymore. But there is a sense of loss that accompanies that. There's a sense of loss about your body, all those physical changes that were described in the video as they're happening. And some of you may be able to remember this personally. You know, you feel awkward. You feel like you went to bed one night with a body you knew and you understood and you knew how it worked. And the next day, it's like, who stole my body and replaced it with this one that the voice squeaks, or, you know, these breasts are developing, or just different, I can't jump or run the way I used to, or different things that happen that, you know, I kind of lost the body I was used to, and now I have this new one I have to get used to. Often adolescents, even separate from being in foster care adoption, you change schools, you know, around eighth grade to ninth, or sometimes sixth to seventh, or whatever it might be in your community. You change schools and often go from one where you kind of were very insulated. You went from first grade to second to third and so on in a group of 20 or 30 other kids that you kind of all stayed together. And then that change of school at the junior high or high school level often is different, and you change classes, and you're not always, and maybe some of your friends went off to a different school at that stage. So you're not losing friends or siblings in the sense of permanent loss, like death or anything, usually, but you're losing your day-to-day contact with them as you do change schools, as you do get sort of placed in different settings, and maybe you're more into sports and your friend is more into arts and your other friend is in the drama club and your other friend doesn't do any of that, or your siblings. There's a loss there. We know that adolescence is a time of experimenting with a lot of sort of relationships, and that comes along with breakups. You know, sometimes it seems like you lose your boyfriend or girlfriend every other week. It seems to from an adult vantage point, oh, come on, that's not that big a deal. You're going to have, you know, that was puppy love, that was a crush. But when you're going through it, it's intense, it's dramatic, and it's real. And that's how it's experienced. And so those losses also are experienced that way. And so each new loss, like those that just listed, can have the potential to trigger a reliving or a re-experiencing of prior losses. So for the child who never was in foster care or never adopted, they go through these types of losses just described, and they can have emotion and emotional upheaval and moodiness that goes with that. But then it kind of settles down. But for the teen that's had an experience of being, in foster care or adoption, that can trigger, oh, people leave me. When I lost someone before, they never came back. And it can re-trigger their trauma. So when that happens, you know, some of their reactions to that can be a variety of things that you might see, or, you know, some of them are a little more invisible, but sometimes a teen might just kind of go into automatic pilot, seem to not even hardly be there. That's be very ambivalent about a lot of things, just cruising through life. And often that withdrawal is a sort of self-protective coat that the teen has on. It doesn't mean that nothing's really happening underneath that, but on the outside, they just look kind of in this automatic pilot type of presence. Sometimes it's an, I can handle anything. I'm an adult now. I can make all my own, decisions. I can reject you before you reject me. Sometimes there's genuine fears of becoming an adult, fears of leaving home. And so they can sabotage their own success. I've seen over and over again, youth that are adopted or were in foster care doing really well in school, getting good grades until their junior or senior year, and then start really falling apart. And many times it's this deeper underlying fear of success and fear of what will happen when they're not in the confines of a safe home and family and neighborhood and school. And so they kind of self-sabotage. Another form of self-sabotage is setting up rejection by deliberately doing things that you think are going to get you, quote, thrown out of your family or of your school. Certainly some of the other ways of coping that teens have at times are those that we've seen that are not healthy types of risks, like running away, turning to drugs or alcohol. Suicide is one of the top leading causes of death for adolescents, and it's much higher, 4, 5, 6, 7 times higher, depending on the studies you look at, for teens who ever had a foster care experience, ever had a juvenile justice experience, ever, had a journey of exploration of whether they were LGBTQ, any of these, if they're racially, African American, Native American, their likelihood, their potential for suicide is even increased. But for all teens, it's quite high. And then maybe we don't see any of these outward kinds of behaviors that I just named here, but the teen may privately kind of be getting through the day, but then privately having their moments of tears. Any of those things I saw, or we just showed earlier, can lead to very impulsive behavior. Teens can become more easily frustrated than they do before and after those years. A 10-year-old and a 20-year-old or 25-year-old can be more stable in their thinking often than a teenager can. So it's both before and after. And this sort of internal worldview that the whole world is scary and unsafe and unpredictable, that nothing is and no one is trustworthy. Sometimes these changes that are happening during adolescence affect memory, short-term memory in particular. And so, you know, they can have a homework assignment on the tip of their tongue when they leave school, and by the time they get home, forget that they even have it. And genuinely, when you say, "Have you done your homework?" and they say, "I don't have any," in that moment, they're believing that. They've really forgotten. They can forget something they learned the day before. And so when they are trying to do that homework assignment, they can't apply the lesson from yesterday because it's really kind of gone. They have maybe extra challenges at school. It's often a time when some of our youth get diagnosed with learning disabilities or things which may or may not be accurate. It may be partly due to their PTSD or trauma that's underlying their inability to focus or pay attention or accomplish academically. So that's why I always say we have to kind of ask ourselves what else might be in their backpack besides school books. And issues around self-expression, especially in traditional sort of talk ways, leading to low self-esteem is also not uncommon. So what can we do as adults? Certainly we can talk with our teens. We can ask them, you know, are there dreams in the sense of what are your hopes and dreams for your future, but also dreams or nightmares, like did you have any dreams last night? We can share. We can, sometimes it's too personal or the teen shuts down if we try to make it too personal. So we can talk about a character in a movie or some lyrics in a song that they like and kind of use those as discussion starters. I see you really like this character in this movie. Do you ever feel that way? Sometimes I feel like that character. Or, oh, you've been listening to this piece of music a lot lately. Can you help me understand why it's meaningful to you? And that phrase, "can you help me understand," is sort of one you should have just on the tip of your tongue. Why did you do this? Or why didn't you do that? Or you know better. If we can replace those kind of phrases with, "can you help me to understand?" It's a much better discussion starter. If we can provide as many as possible opportunities for our teens to have legitimate and safe control in their lives, whether that's, you know, through activities like sports and arts and things, whether that's through deciding their parts of their daily schedule, you know, whether they do homework after school or after dinner, and, you know, not being providing some structure but not being too rigid and giving them some opportunities to have some of their own control. Sometimes when they can't express things verbally, being able to just do things with their hands, having some hands-on craft activities, art, pottery, some of these things, or science even, experimenting, can be very helpful. And then helping them, you know, identify what their own needs are. So coming back, circling back around at the top, I said talk to them, but at the bottom here, I'm saying, you know, balance that out. You want them to understand, I'm here for you. I'll talk with you. I'll be there for you. But I'm also going to respect sometimes you need your privacy. So sometimes you need to come to me. I'm not always going to be beating down your door. I'm not always going to be taking the initiative. We really have to balance that. Sometimes we do have to knock on the door, but other times we have to back off. And that's a difficult dance sometimes, but one we have to pay attention to learning as the adults in the life of the child. So we know that, again, back to the science, that youth who are going through a lot of these challenges, if they have these things, if they do have lasting connections with at least one caring adult, if they do really have a sense of connection in their school in particular, because they spend so much time there. So if you have a teen that's been uprooted, been moved from one school to another, you know, really helping them find that place of connection in school, whether that's through an activity, whether it's through even one adult in the school who shows an interest, knows them by name, takes a personal interest in them. That sense of connection in school is extremely important. Developing positive, you know, self-esteem and coping skills, and then having access to whatever care they need for any mental or physical needs, healthcare, disability, ability, or even substance use and abuse, making sure they have the access to the right supports for any needs along those lines. So we're going to look in the next few minutes here at several of these tasks that adolescent is going through in their development. While all this brain stuff is happening, what's kind of the end goal? Why is it all happening? What are the tasks that in terms of human development, they should come out the other side of this brain development with? So some of these tasks include, it's a very important period for identity formation in all respects. So adolescents do a lot of that, who am I? And I'll go on and I'll have a slide or two about each of these points as we go forward here. But, you know, not just who am I, you know, what's my identity, but in some of the harder areas like my sexual and gender identity, my race, my culture, my religion, my language, a sense of belonging, particularly as it relates to how do I or don't I fit in with my peers. And then it is an opportunity for that moral and value development occurs at a higher level than it previously did. And so we'll unpack and talk a little about each of these over the next few minutes. So in terms of that piece of adolescent identity development, I have a picture here of kids on a trampoline, because it's my best metaphor or analogy of a way to describe what's happening with their sense of identity development. As the first bullet says, they need to try out or try on different identities. So what's going on a lot with your adolescent is, it's kind of like what's going on with a person on a trampoline. The goal when you're jumping on a trampoline is to get as high, to get as far away from the trampoline as possible. But that's only possible when they have that base that they can return to that's safe. And so the trampoline itself, when you see someone jumping on one, it kind of catches and relaunches you as you jump and try to get more height, more distance. That's what our teens are doing. They're trying to get more far away. They might seem like they're trying to get far away from you. They're going to try on identities that look like they're rejecting your values, rejecting what you stand for as a family, rejecting who you are as a person. Cassie talked a lot about that in that opening video. We looked at how she just really kept showing rejection, rejection, rejection of that family that she later came to realize how much she loved. But they were the supportive trampoline. They were there for her. They caught her each time and just kept at it and kept at it. And for teens who move a lot from one foster home to another, it's like, you're trying to do that jumping, but the trampoline keeps moving, or the trampoline is broken, or the trampoline's just not there. So we really have to be like those parents were in that opening video. We have to just be the stable ones that are there, even while they're doing this sort of trampoline identity shaping process, as that can seem painful at times. It can feel very personal and feel very much like we're being rejected. One of the things we can do as a young person is kind of going through this exploring, you know, who am I, where have I been, where am I going, who's my family, is help them develop a life book that kind of helps them put their pieces of their life together. And I say the word life book because that's used a lot in foster care and adoption, but it could be a life story in some other way. It could be a scrapbook, it could be a digital story, a video like the one we saw of Cassie. It could be a PowerPoint presentation about their life. And when I say presentation, doesn't mean they have to present it to anyone. It's just that could be an organizing structure they use. Or it could even just be a box or a footlocker or a drawer where they keep things that have meaning for them. But helping them sort of put their pieces together, giving them the space, giving them the tools to do that is really useful. Now, as our guy said in the video, one of the things that's happening is that there's many physical changes going on in adolescence. This guy with the, you know, standing on stilts, it kind of makes me think of that. It's like all of a sudden you're different. You're not, don't have the same body you had before. But those physical changes can be sudden. They can be very disconcerting and often lead to a lot of fatigue and exhaustion. Again, he pointed that out in the video. So what that may mean is that the time of day that's best for our young person might not be best for us. One of our teens, when he was going through a lot of teen angst and we were having a lot of challenging issues with him, we finally figured out that if we were going to have good communication with him, it had to be after midnight. And that was not our best time. We liked to be asleep, you know, by 10 o'clock. So we had to sort of make appointments with him from time to time where we would stay up and we would sit down like at midnight with a snack and have a conversation. And that was really one of the best parenting tricks we used to help us get through his adolescence in particular. Something that can be difficult for families to recognize is that this is a period for almost all teens where they're at least, you know, understanding what is my gender identity? What does it mean to be male or female? What does it mean to be who I am? What is my gender? What is my identity? And there's some questioning about sexual orientation that goes on and seeking sort of who am I in this way? And who can I ask these questions to? Who will be there for me to support me if I have questions? Sadly, one of the highest leading causes of youth being thrown out of their homes and entering the foster care system is because of being rejected by family for going through this sort of questioning period of time and process. And it's also one of the highest reasons for suicide. So being able to be there or provide some adult that can be there to help, that you trust, that can help your child safely explore these questions is really valuable. And for more resource on that, there's a woman by the name of Caitlin Ryan, and she has a body of work called the Family Acceptance Project, where she has a lot of materials to help families, regardless of, you know, your view on these questions, how you can hold on to your own values and at the same time help support your child's exploration of their identity in ways that don't lead to suicide, in ways that don't lead to rejection, complete rejection, and so on. So that's a really good resource to be aware of. Similarly, another topic that's challenging for a lot of families and young people during these years is the is racial identity development. And really understanding sort of who am I? What is my race? Maybe I'm living with people of the same race as me. Maybe I'm living with people who have a different race than me. So what does that mean? How do I express my understanding of my own racial identity? How do I cope with responses I might get from other people towards me as a person with a race, whether from my inside circle, my family and friends, or from the larger world? Again, is there someone I have available to turn to for safe, trustworthy support as I grapple with these kinds of challenging questions? Adolescence is a big period of moral and spiritual development. What do I believe? What's right and wrong? How do I make decisions prior to adolescence? Most children, as they're developing, sort of just kind of accept and emulate whatever values they're around, whatever the adults around them have. They kind of, those are their values by default, and often more fear-based as relates to authority. Well, I'm not going to cross any lines because I don't want to get in trouble, not because I believe something is right or wrong. I haven't really questioned that yet, but I just don't want to get in trouble. But in the adolescent years, they begin to question, well, what do I believe? And is there something that's worth getting in trouble for? How do I make those decisions? I have this picture of the cell phone here. It's an interesting little example of suppose you were observing a situation where there's somebody left behind their phone on a bench, and you see a teen walk up and take that phone. And what does that tell us about that teen's morals or values, that they just walked up and took it and walked off with it? Well, if we unpack it a little more, what if it was a teen who said, yep, I want it. It's not mine, but someone left it there, so they deserve to lose it if they left it behind. You know, I take what I want. Or if upon further exploration, we found out that the teen who saw it 10 yards away was aware of someone that was in a crisis, someone who had passed out, someone who had fallen and couldn't get up, someone who was going through danger, and they didn't have their own phone with them, but they saw this line and said, oh good, now I can call for help for that person that needs help. I'm going to use this as a tool to get help for someone else. Maybe that gives you a different understanding of their moral or value development. Or what if you talk to the teen later and they said, yeah, I took that because I didn't want someone to steal it, and I'm going to commit myself to finding the rightful owner. I'm going to figure out who owns this and get it back to them, because that's what I would want someone to do if that happened to me, if I lost my phone. You see, there could be three different reasons, and there could be a multitude more, but there could be at least three different reasons why that teen might have picked up that phone, that are based on very different places in their moral development. So it's important to kind of do those little exercises. There's little video clips on YouTube and stuff that you can find about values development, where you can actually do these in your home with your child and say, what would you do in that situation? And then, well, what if this? What if someone was having an emergency? Or what if you could throw in some what if questions and just really help them practice exploring what it means to be a moral person, what it means to make right or wrong decisions. A few years ago, there actually was a book published basically with this title, Get Out of My Life, But First Drive Me to the Mall. And it was about parenting adolescents. And it basically was about that tug of war between I need you, but I don't want to need you. I need you, but I don't need you. You know, I need you to do stuff for me, but I don't really want people to see you with me. One of our daughters, during this period in her life, she had to walk to school, and she hated that walk. And she would, you know, if there was the slightest hint of rain or she had a project to carry in or something, she would always ask for a ride. But she would always say, drop me off, you know, a block away from the school. She wasn't quite sure she wanted to be seen with us, but she wanted that help. So it kind of can feel like a tug of war of how do I support my young person in becoming more more independent, but at the same time supporting them and showing them that I still have a lifelong commitment to them. So one of the ways we do this is to think of our role in their life during these adolescent years more as a coaching approach. You know, we're taking on a coaching approach, we're giving them tutoring and coaching and guidance, but also giving them opportunity to practice, even when practice means in some areas falling down, making a mistake, and getting back up and trying again. In order to engage our teens, we have to understand how are they communicate. You know, they're doing texting and tweeting and Instagramming and Snapchatting. Do we know all the lingo? Do we know what PO, if we walk by our teen and they've got their phone in front of them and suddenly they type to their friend POS and then they type something else, do we know what POS means? Well, it means parent over shoulder. So they're not going to type something that, you know, they don't want you to know, maybe. It's important to learn the lingo. And I used to give out a handout about this, but I really don't anymore because it changes so rapidly. But you can find these kind of sort of glossaries of lingo, texting lingo and stuff. You can find them online. You know, but it's a time when teens often try to experiment with tattoos or piercings or body art. You know, and how does that affect how they view their own body image in this world of a selfie culture? What music is important to them? What video games are they playing? And how, instead of sort of banning or allowing, instead of sort of seeing it in this either or way, how can we engage with them and find out how they understand why or how this is important to you? Don't become their bud, their buddy, but understanding their realm, their world, and how they express themselves so that you can then communicate in ways that demonstrate caring and love and respect. And when you do want to have those serious conversations, thinking about the time, the place, you know, the media, the ways you're going to give them to express their feelings is really important. And I said earlier, another of the areas that our young people need is skills. But just learning skills in an academic way, taking a class, life skills, things like that, there's no harm in that. Sometimes people learn good skills in those. But what's even more important is for young people to learn skills in the context of relationships. You know, learning to cook by cooking with someone that cares for you, learning to manage money by actually sitting down and doing a budget with someone who cares about you, learning to maintain calm in a crisis by seeing how an adult you care about maintains calm in a crisis. And a lot of the skills that young people need are these that are here. They need critical thinking and problem-solving skills. I'm going to show you a quick model for that in a moment. They need to know, you know, when I can't figure something out, who's trustworthy? How do I get advice? How do I get support? Oh, how they need the soft skills that will help them maintain a job or an apartment or anything like that. You know, being punctual, being reliable, all those things that are listed there on the slide, as well as then the concrete skills for living that are often the subject matter that might be taught in classes, but also can be, again, learned through doing in the context of relationship. Now, I mentioned problem solving as an important skill, and I just want to mention this one type of problem solving strategy to you. It's called SODAS, and it stands for, the S is the situation. Describe, what's a situation that you're facing or that you did face and you want to kind of learn from it? What are the options? What options do you have if it's an upcoming situation, or did you have if it's something that already went past? D and A, what are the disadvantages and advantages, you know, another way of saying pros and cons, of each situation, of each option, I apologize. What are the disadvantages and advantages of each option? And then factoring all that in, how do I come to my solution? As the young person develops that ability to begin doing good problem solving, then you can help them prepare for their future. You can do it together. You can help them articulate goals. You can help them learn how to advocate for themselves and use those problem-solving skills that you've worked on. But you also want to make future plans together so the young person knows, you know, you're not throwing me out. Even if I become more independent, even once I eventually go off to college or trade school or military service or just getting my own apartment, you know, we still have a relationship. We're still a family. So talk about the ways that you're going to still do things together, even putting dates on the calendar, like a year from now, we're still going to have that fishing trip, or we're still going to have that shopping trip, or we're still going to, you know, you're going to come over and have a sleepover, and we're going to do some of the things we did when you were young. So really help them see that you're still going to be in their life, even as their future unfolds. And then we're just down to the last couple of slides I wanted to share, just to remind you that all of those things that I've shared so far are valuable no matter who your teen is or how your teen came into your life. But, you know, if your teen does have special needs, then it's important to work through the school and find out what they have available for resources for transition into adulthood types of planning. As you transition your teen into adult health care providers, is your teen eligible for things like services from vocational rehabilitation or SSI? You know, be looking into these things jointly with your teen so that they don't just suddenly kind of fall off a cliff, but you're creating this bridge. That's why I have the bridge picture here. And frankly, we do know that some teens sometimes do things very beyond the risk-taking I talked about earlier, but more in the sense of being a danger to themselves or others through, you know, drug use, through doing activities that are illegal. So it's really important here to always understand there's a difference between living together and belonging in a relationship. There may be times when your young person is in this category of being a danger to self or others and either makes life choices where they can't live with you any longer, maybe has to be in a residential treatment facility, maybe gets arrested and goes to jail. But even in those situations, you have to ask yourself, how can I still maintain the relationship? How can I still let my child know you still matter to me and your life still has value, even if you can't live under my roof? We still have a connection. We still have a relationship. So with that said, though, I would like to end on the note that the most important thing we can do to help our teens and ourselves get through those teen years and get to that point where Cassie was at the end of her video in the beginning of our time together, is this: if we focus on positive thoughts, expressions of gratitude, and building on relationships, because the brain, most importantly, learns through repetition. And so if we repeat a lot of negativity and venting and, you know, separation, if that's what's repeated with our teens, that's what their brain will learn to, you know, hold on to. But if we repeat a lot of positivity, reflection of in positive ways, showing of gratitude, and, you know, that you matter to me, that this relationship is important, then we can build those strong, bright lights, is illustrated here, in their brain, that will help them go forward in a future as an adult in the most positive way possible. So on that note, that's what I have for you today, and I thank you for staying with me, and I hope you found it helpful.
Thank you so much, Sue. That was incredible. Very, very helpful. I did have one question I wanted to ask. So you're talking about ways for an adult to connect. Do you have any ideas for making that initial connection? I know we have some classes, some host families that we'll be hosting this summer. Just any good ways come to mind for making that very initial connection with a new child that may be coming into your home or into your life?
Yeah, I think the most important thing is to, you know, just really ask what do you care most about? What do you like to do? And then trying to dig a little deeper behind it and say, you know, show me. Help me understand why that matters to you. Is that something I could do with you? Is that something you could teach me about? If you put the youth in the position of teaching the adult or sharing with the adult, it's a great icebreaker, and it's a great way to sort of understand what's important to them. If they're not ready, or if they kind of shrug that off, you know, coming to some more sensory experiences, you know, being more direct, like what food is a good icebreaker? What kind of food do you most like? You know, let's plan a couple of days worth of food. Or how about if you're going to be living with me, how about every Tuesday you get to plan the menu or help us decide what we're going to eat? So if you can't get into more real specific personal things, then start with something like that, sort of generic like food. Also doing activities together rather than just sort of sitting face-to-face talking, but whether it's throwing a frisbee together, whether it's coloring together, whether it's taking a walk, doing the shopping, but actually doing something together and then just sort of seeing how the conversation develops while you're actually engaged and doing something rather than just sort of sitting.
Yeah, that's great. Very helpful. Thank you so very much, Sue.